You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yeah, come on in and catch some. As a matter of fact, it's sort of ironic on this program because today we're talking about, you know, we talked about new lure skirts. We talked about sunglasses, the Polaroid, how to see a fish on the top of the ocean. Well, time to put the skirts aside. Well, maybe not all skirts, but certainly time to put the sunglasses aside, because we're going to talk about what we call, in some circles, the Magnificent Seven, but more often than not, the Deep Seven. And the Deep Seven refer to the seven most popular bottom fish here in the Hawaiian Islands. And to join in us today from the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council is Marlo Sabater. He's a PhD. He's a scientist. As a matter of fact, he is the marine ecosystem scientist for the council. And we always get together with Malloy and talk story about what his favorite thing is, and that's getting out, I guess, in the field and doing a little fishing. Malloy, nice to see you again. Thanks for joining
morning.
Us. You know, I guess maybe a real good beginning would be was how these fish were deemed to become the Deep Seven, and what separates the Deep Seven from all the other fish that you can find in deep water.
All right. So initially, it started when the council started managing the bottom fish fishery mm-hmm. in Hawaii.
And, by the way, on the mainland, our counterparts on the mainland, they don't call it bottom fishing, right? They call them ground fishing.
Right.
So, but it's interchangeable. We're talking bottom fish, right?
Right. Bottom fish. Mm-hmm. So initially, in the bottom fish fishery management plan, there's all of the species that are caught using the bottom fishing gear mm-hmm. is considered in the bottom fish fishery.
Okay.
And eventually, the council decided to separate out the Deep Seven because those are the primary species of commercial value.
Now, the word deep means right. a lot of things to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Some people think 60 feet is kind of deep.
Right.
I do know that you can find these species sometimes in shallower water, but generally speaking, what kind of depth are we talking about?
It's probably those species that are greater than like 100 fathoms.
Yeah, that's 600 right. feet, by the way. That's,
right.
That's deep.
But it varies depending on mm-hmm. the species. So,
yeah.
And bottom fish is kind of misleading because some of these deep seven species doesn't necessarily stay at the bottom.
Yeah, that's interesting too, because you would think that these things by their size alone wouldn't be able to travel the whole water column, but apparently sometimes they do. Like every now and again, somebody will be fishing, say, on the Penguin Banks off Oahu, and they'll catch a deep water bottom fish
right.
in shallow water.
Right. Yeah. A fisherman knows exactly where this species are. They
mm-hmm.
know contrary to popular belief, this is actually a targeted fishery.
Yeah.
So fishermen knows, the really good ones really know where to go, at what time of the day,
yeah.
when they're going to bite and when they're not going to bite.
It's terrific. And here, I will agree with you in this. I know if somebody says, we want paka, we want to eat opaka paka, that's what they want.
Right.
And they're going to go to any place they got to go to get it. You can't just say, well, take some mai-mai instead, because they want that one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if either one of us are qualified to answer the question, but what makes these things so special as far as being a preferred fish to eat? Why are they so desired?
Well, the redfish demand is practically high because of, you know, it has cultural significance.
Mm-hmm.
The demand for redfish comes out during like Christmas or
later
part of the year. Redfish is like a popular fish.
Malloy, we've talked about this in past. If you are having a local party come holidays, you have to have an onaga right in the middle of that plate, right?
Oh, yeah.
But I also think that there are certain things that are significantly valuable about the meat, because they must be sought after for a reason. Maybe it's perceived that they make you feel better, or there's more of this, or there's more of that. Something's in these fish that's good for you.
Right. This is the this is a highly valued white meat
mm-hmm.
fishery, and there's only a handful of fisheries that produce a white meat fish, because Hawaii is a red.
You can't tell somebody that wants paka, oh, here, have some aku. Because that's what they want. It's just
right.
like telling somebody to eat sand. I mean, if they really want to have something different.
Right.
But the interesting thing was, it was only recently, when I would say recently, in the recent past, where we've actually been establishing catch limits and seasons and size limits and some of the other things. And I know there's a lot of pushback in the community about these things. I think that maybe you could even redefine what that is. What we're going to talk about a little bit today is what they call the ACL. Is that the annual catch limit?
That's the annual catch limit.
Okay.
And annual catch limits is actually a requirement that was put out by Congress in the 2007 reauthorization of the Magnuson-Stevenson
Act.
So that required a council to establish annual catch limits for all fisheries in its fishery ecosystem plans.
What a task that is, huh?
It's a huge task, especially if you're dealing with a region that has very little data and very little scientific information.
I know that in what you do as a scientist, they have that saying, I think it's garbage in, garbage out. You know, if you put in funny kind numbers, you get funny kind numbers out. I don't even know if we are able to improve the way that we're doing evaluations or not, but there is certainly a lot of discussion about that going on.
Right, and the Science Center is actually the lead in trying to assess the status of the bottom fish stocks, especially the Deep Seven. They generate a what they call a stock assessment, where it tells you whether the stock is overfished or is experiencing overfishing or not. So this is the science that the council uses to make its decision.
Okay, in recent weeks past, like last week, we had Charlie Ka'ai'i on talking about some of the indigenous fisher folks. And what I think is interesting in this is when you take a look at what this Deep Seven task, if you will, that it varies a lot from place to place, and even within that island from place to place. In other words, reef to reef, or drop off to drop off. Is the data being used for a wide area?
Right now, we're trying to use all the data that's available because there's only a handful of data that's out there that's specific for the Deep Seven.
Can you explain that a little bit, Malloy, as far as the data that is being used, where does it come from?
Right. So most of the data that's being used in the stock assessment comes from the CML database of the Division of Aquatic Resources.
Mm-hmm.
So the fishermen reports if they catch Deep Seven bottom fish,
right,
and they submit this on a weekly basis. So the CPUE from that, which CPUE means catch per unit effort, is the one that's being used by the Science Center to generate a stock assessment.
Isn't this rather a kind of new category that needs some explaining, that even fishermen have to know what this effort means, that it's not from the moment you hook up your trailer to till you get back? There's specific things that they're looking at here.
Right. So the more accurate you report your effort, will really affect or significantly improve the data that goes into the stock assessment. So the way the stock assessment use catch per unit effort, they assume that if your catch per unit effort increase, that will be an indicator that there's more fish in the ocean. So
right.
More fish, higher CPUE. Less fish, less CPUE. So the less fish there are in the ocean, the harder it is to catch it, so your CPUE would go down.
I think one of the variables that's always been of interest to me in the bottom fishery is that this fishery is a lot of space that's outside. In other words, it's a huge area that we're talking about. And there must be plenty of areas that maybe aren't fished, and there's plenty of fish, but we don't know about that yet. Don't we tend to go back to this? Doesn't a bottom fisherman tend to go back to the same place all the time and go fish?
Typically, that's the case. Mm-hmm. And they know, and it's a highly kept secret for the bottom fishermen.
And yet they wouldn't keep going back there if it wasn't working.
Right.
They got their hole. That's their hole, right?
Right, yeah. Right. So they have specific areas where they and also features of the bottom that they keep an eye out on. So some of them discover new fishing grounds, some of them don't. They just keep on going to their traditional fishing
grounds. Let's talk a little bit about where you came from on your way to Hawaii. I mean, today we're looking at technology and equipment that can put you right back on the same hole that you were at 5 years ago on the same day. In different parts of the Pacific, this is still done. I understand a lot of it is anecdotally, and landmarks and all kinds of different ways to go and remember where they caught.
Right, yeah. Right. So a lot of the traditional bottom fish fishermen, well, from American Samoa, for example, they go by with traditional knowledge. They go where their fathers or their the chief fishermen, their master fishermen, taught them where to go.
Did you find any evidence, or is there any evidence to suggest that there were systems within those practices where if they weren't catching a certain species at a place they thought to catch it, that they would not try to catch any for a while to hope that it comes back, or do they just go look for somewhere else?
There is a traditional system in place in the area that I used to work, and they, you know, they...
This was in American Samoa.
This is in American Samoa, and, you know, they, whenever they go out to fish, they only get what they, you know, what they need, because there's not... American Samoa doesn't really have a huge commercial fishery. They only supply fish... you know, based on the local demand.
Yeah.
So it's not a big island, so there's not a whole lot
of demand. And everybody wants it fresh, so they don't want 3, 4, 5 day old fish. They want to catch, they want to get what's got.
Right.
How did, but what did you observe there as far as the, I guess it was just a secret of then that those fishermen, they don't want to let the other guys know where they go either. Yeah. But that they pretty much stick to one place?
They pretty much stick to one place, and they, you know, the area that they go to is really productive because you know they've been going there routinely for the whole year, and there were even in the 80s I think there was a depletion experiment that that was done in American Samoa where they fished out you know a seamount. Some of them bounced back, some of them didn't, so it's really area specific.
I wonder what has what the determining factor is, because obviously if you've got a pinnacle or seamount that you talk about out in the deep that comes up shallow and you can catch fish, there must be something attracting those fish other than just the depth.
Right. So underwater features are one of those things that attract fish, and you know, to them it's habitat, it's shelter. Imagine yourself in a wide open space, and you know that there's a predator lurking around the corner. And if you don't have any space to hide, you know, you immediately look for a place where, you know, there's a structure that you can go to,
or where somebody probably won't try to. Maybe the hole's not big enough for them to swim in and get you.
Right.
Yeah. Is there a marked difference in Samoa about the kinds of fishermen? I mean, you got the inshore, the divers, just like we do, and then the behind the reef guys, and then the deep water guys. Is it similarly broken up?
Yeah. The fishermen has different techniques. They have different niches. So there are a group of spear fishermen on the island. There are bottom fishermen. There are trollers. So
what about the gear? I mean, you know, when you talk about the bottom fishery around the main Hawaiian islands, a lot of guys are using hydraulics. They're using, you know, you got to. I mean, it's deep. You know, they got to do something. But there still are some traditional guys that are out there handlining and going in deep water with their hand lines.
Right. So that's the main difference between American Samoa and Hawaii. Mm-hmm. That Hawaii uses the technology to harvest the deep water snappers, and in American Samoa, you know, there are some of them that stick with wooden reels.
Yeah,
homemade wooden reels.
I've seen them. It's just amazing that they have the patience to reel that thing all the way up from the bottom. But how has that increased the catch effort? Because if you have a you know, a large damashi line of 5 or 10 or 12 hooks and a bottom fishing reel, you know, that fish comes up like pretty quick, you know, so you can get those lines right back in the water pretty quick.
So it is critical to document the history of the bottom fish fishery, how the gear changed over time, because that affects the what the stock assessment people call the catchability coefficient, Q. So in a stock assessment, the CPUE would depend on the catchability. So you assume that the changes in the CPUE is due to abundance and not the change
that's
in the
really
technology.
Yeah, exactly. Because in some respects, you could argue, wait a minute, it's not abundance. It's that the guy can fish more.
Right.
So it's the same amount of fish, you're just bringing out more at once. But doesn't that also speak to what they will take? Like you said, in Samoa, they'll tend to take only what they need for that or the next couple of days. Where some people here, based on different methods of preserving or marketing, they'll take all they can once they find them.
Right. And, you know, how much they take and what the disposition is for those, whether it's for family or for commercial or whatever. All affects the catch per unit effort.
Okay, now just so that people understand where the data comes from. Once again, you said it's from mostly the commercial guys. They're coming up and documenting their catch. I know some of that comes from like the places like the auction and other places. But what about the What about the non-commercial fishery? Even though the guy's got the BF letters on his boat, he's a bottom fisherman, but he doesn't sell it. Where is his data? How is his data managed?
If you're a non-commercial bottom fisherman and you caught, you have a BF thing on your mark on your boat, and you caught a deep seven species, you're required to report it as long as you have a CML. So as if you caught a deep seven bottom fish, you have to report it. So some of the non-commercial fishermen report their catch on the CML, because there is the other part where you're required to have some sort of a non-commercial bottom fish permit.
Yeah.
And that gives you a bag limit or something. I think it's more expensive to get that compared to a CML.
Yeah. However, just as people used to be close to the vest about their specific place where they fished, that's not of interest. I mean, you need a grid area. You need an area, but not a specific number. But what about the fisherman's willingness to part with that? With that data, in other words, fess up or admit to what they catch, because if they don't, isn't there a likelihood that the science will say, well, there's only this area can only take so much, and so that's what we're going to limit it to?
Right. So the stock assessment, what they do, they standardize by the area as well.
Mm-hmm.
So reporting accurately where you got the fish is important, because you need to control for those different variables.
We know that there was a great deal of elation a few years back when the data showed that the marketplace could take, I think at that point, 386,000 pounds or whatever it was, and that everybody was pleased with the fact that, okay, we gave our information up, but it didn't affect our limit. They kept the limit. Now, over the next couple of years, this season and the next couple of seasons, that catch limit has been reduced. And I know that some fishermen are pushing back about that. What was the science that was used to say, okay, we can't keep catching at the same rate, we need to cut back a bit?
Right. So the stock assessment is really the driver. And this is a document that's produced by the Pacific Island Fisheries Science Center. And so whenever you do a stock assessment update, the numbers, you would almost expect that the numbers would change. Whether the change in the number is, the number goes up or the number goes down, it's really affected by the data that goes in. So in the previous years, where I think it was the 2011 stock assessment, the numbers went up because they started to account for, the non-commercial landing.
Right,
they had some assumption about the non-commercial landing or the unreported landing.
Yeah, some of that, I believe, was the enforcement at boat ramps and places like that. I shouldn't say enforcement, but inspection. And some of it was maybe more than just anecdotal. There was actually some pretty good numbers. But I do know that even that was kind of questioned. And that brings into the fact, isn't the data that's used always going to be questioned? There's always going to be somebody not happy with it?
There's always going to be question about data, the quality of the data, the quantity of the data, and why you're not using certain types of data. So that's why it's important for the stock assessment to be inclusive of all data sets that's available. And being accurate in your reporting of your catch per unit effort, like you should report the actual soak time of your hook, not when you left the
the make port sure, and let's came make back. Sure people understand that. When he says soak time, it's those of you that are using lay nets and everything, you already know the term. You know, putting your net in the truck and putting it in your boat and taking it out to the reef, that nobody cares about that. They care about how long it's in the water.
Right.
And that's the soak.
And how many fish you caught during that time.
On what gear?
On what gear?
Yeah.
Number of hooks in the water. Bottom fish fishery has different gear configuration.
Well, I mean, let's just take the weekend warrior guy that goes to the fishing supply store and he buys his little damashi. There might be 10 on the package. So that is not one, it's 10 hooks.
Yep,
right?
10 hooks in the water. And also the expertise of the bottom fish fishermen as well.
Yeah.
There are guys that's this is a highly skilled fishery, so there are guys that's really good at what they're doing. Even if they even if they have only one hook in the water and they can catch more.
Yeah, if it's at the right place. Yeah,
if it's on the right place. So there's a lot of factors that you need to consider. So a highly skilled fisherman, even for just one hook in the water, can catch 10 fish as compared to a newbie that has 10 hooks in the water and couldn't even catch one.
That's what I, you know, we have from time to time, many of our listeners know, we get the guys from Wicked Tuna. On the show, and now there's this Wicked Tuna Outer Banks, and they're using the green stick for catching the big bluefin and some others. And it is true that the experience level of some of the skippers that come from, say, Gloucester or whatever, and they go to the Outer Banks, they're not as good. It's not because they're junk fishermen. It's just that they don't know that area and they don't know how to fish that area. Isn't it almost the same thing here?
It's the same thing here.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay, so you've mentioned already several times the stock assessment. What is that? I mean, what comprises, say, the stock assessment right now in one area for these deep seven?
Okay, so the stock assessment is a an analysis how good your stock is based on available data. So it's going to tell you how the productivity of your stock and how much effort is being exerted on that stock to harvest the fish. So it gauges whether your stock is in good health or not, and whether your fishery is big enough or small enough to harvest the maximum number of fish out in the water.
So okay, you know, when we talked about this once before, and I'm not sure that I grasp this, and that means that there's probably some listeners that don't get it either. Not only does there have to be some consistency with the actual count of the fish, but the other ancillary stuff that you're talking about, the gear, the soak time, the number of hooks, all the other stuff. Who at the end of the line is the one that releases that assessment?
Okay, so at the end of the day, the stock assessment is a product of the Science Center.
Mm-hmm.
And so the process before that goes to management, but before that even gets to the manager, is that stock assessment will have to be reviewed independently. And so from there, the review is going to tell you the nitty-gritty of, you know, whether you did the assessment correct or not.
Yeah.
So based on that review, the reviewers will say that, yeah, it's acceptable or not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So if the review says it's acceptable, then that's the time when the council takes that stock assessment, and the council's scientific and statistical committee, which is the science body of the council, will take that assessment and the review, and then will make its best available science determination for the council.
Gotcha. Okay,
and that would also be the basis for, and that's when this whole ACL mechanism kicks in. That's going to be the basis for
the
SSC's determination of acceptable biological catch, accounting for scientific uncertainty. And from that recommendation, the council will make its own recommendation on what the annual catch limit would be for that particular fishery.
Okay. Remember the last couple times that we've been hanging out together at the Fishermen's Forum, it was the 163rd meeting of the council a while back that we had the Fishers Forum. And at that time, when this stock assessment came out and some of those young scientists were displaying the fruits of their labor, that some of the fishermen said, well, why don't you do this and why don't you do that? I felt that there was sort of a bottoms-up effort being made to include more anecdotal, cultural, you know what I mean?
Right.
Listen to some of the kupuna. They may not write stuff down, but they got pretty good memory.
Yeah, so stock assessment scientists typically are just focused on the science, right?
Mm-hmm.
And interpreting what those numbers are, we rely on the fishermen to tell us what these are. So it's imperative or it's critical that you have that link between a scientist and the fisherman, so that the scientist would know will have the in-depth knowledge of what those numbers really mean.
Yeah, you know what I'm worried about sometimes? That the scientist realizing what a responsibility and a burden that is would be too conservative, and therefore the fisherman would get upset and not pay the rules. But I think maybe a fisherman should hear from a scientist like you and others what the impact is in the whole ecosystem that you specialize in when you do deplete, when you either inadvertently or Mother Nature or some other reason, let's say you catch all the paca and they're no more, then what happens? How long does it take for these areas to recover? So from what I heard, a lot sometimes takes a long time.
Right, right. So if a stock gets overfished and it would require some sort of a rebuilding plan, what they call a rebuilding plan. Mm-hmm. So,
which means a lot of limitations.
A lot of limitations, right? Yeah. Right now, we don't have any stocks right now in the bottom fish fishery, for example, mm-hmm. is not overfished, not experiencing overfishing. So we will not require any rebuilding plan for that. But in case it becomes overfished, then that would trigger a requirement by Magnuson to establish a rebuilding plan for that stock.
Yeah, I think what's interesting in that is that they've used some information, especially on the eastern seaboard, of pelagic fish that get depleted by either limiting size or season or whatever. And here in Hawaii, we've been actually kind of unrestricted, for a long, long time. So it must be sometimes hard, particularly for some of the older fishermen, to accept limitations.
Right, and there's also the state angle to this, right? Mm-hmm. There are some state rules and regulation that mm-hmm. needs to be followed for the same set of stocks. So there's layers of management for the different fisheries.
Certainly where that overlap is. Do we find ourselves scientifically, do you think it's that the information, the shoreline information and the deeper water information is being blended as well as it can be, or do we still have ways to improve the way we do this calculation?
There are ways to improve on the data, surely. And like I said, majority of our stock in the Western Pacific are in a data limited state.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know much about life history, the productivity. All we have for most of our fisheries, particularly coral reef, for example, is catch data with some intermittent length data from specific programs that we have all over the place.
We talked off the air before we started, Malloy, about the different methods that are used to compile the information. And it seems like it's kind of still in its primitive stage, but we are taking a look with video, with equipment, with cameras now. And I think that's kind of neat, And yet you're limited by how many cameras and how much ground it is. Do you see that sort of move helping, that we can get some value out of this?
Definitely. If there's a lot of question about the catch per unit effort as a metric for abundance,
mm-hmm.
then surely anything that doesn't rely on catch per unit effort information is better. Right now the Pacific Island Fisheries Science Center is exploring use of camera systems
mm-hmm.
to have an independent estimate of abundance. So if you have a camera out there that's configured right with inputs from the fishermen, what they know about the fish behavior, location and things like that, then that'll help a lot in terms of trying to get, okay, how much fish are really out there versus, okay, from the catch record, this is how much we're getting. So if you can put those two things together,
mm-hmm.
then that'll give you a better idea of what the real status of
I heard this
is.
One guy say at the meeting, hey, wait a minute. What happens if you just happen to get to the lucky hole where there's plenty of fish? What about the hole next door where there's no fish? You put a camera over there, you don't see a fish all day. I do know that there's a lot of pushback in that. But what are some of the things that are coming up right now where the work that you're doing on this, on the ACLUs, what's going on today?
Not so much for the bottom fish fishery, because mm-hmm. we do have a system that's working for the bottom fish fishery. For the coral reef fishery, for example, where we don't have a lot of information, the council is trying to improve on the ACL specification process by using a little bit more of a data a model based approach.
Mm-hmm.
So we're collaborating with scientists to develop a some sort of a model. Instead of basing your catch limit from an average measure of the catch, which we know is affected by all sorts of stuff, mm-hmm. We're trying to incorporate other information like biomass, life history, average length information into the estimation of a sustainable yield. And from there, you can specify ACLs based on that.
What I think is neat about that, and the way we're going to finish up today, Malloy, is that, in a perfect world, this stuff would be all easy to calculate. But here you are in a field that you must be saying sometimes, boy, you have to have an awful lot of patience for what's going on in order for these decisions to be made.
Right.
you know, we all have to, patience is a virtue, I think.
Right.
Anyway, thank you so much for joining us. It's always a pleasure seeing you. Okay, that's going to do it for this this episode of Go Fish. Just a reminder that we're brought to you by this segment, the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council. And if you want to hear something on the program or you want to know more about the council, go to wpcouncil.org. See some of the stuff Malloy's talking about, some of this ACL stuff. And it's really, really interesting and how it's compiled. And more importantly, how many different stakeholders there are. It's fantastic. So if you want to hear something on the program, you know what to do. Drop me a line, themikebuckshow@aol.com. themikebuckshow@aol.com. So for everybody at POP Fishing and Marine, and of course, the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Aloha.